What's up, guys? Welcome to the Hypertrophy Cast. My name is Luis Frielingsdorf. I'm the podcast host, and this is another English episode because today we are joined by Brian Miner, and I'm really excited for our conversation. Brian is a pro natural bodybuilder, powerlifter. He has a Master of Science in Health and Exercise Science and is the owner of BD Miner Coaching. Awesome to have you on here today, Brian. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm fine as well. So, your last bodybuilding competition was in 2017, where you brought in an insane package and reached extreme levels of conditioning. But you mentioned that you are not sure whether you will compete again in natural bodybuilding. So what are your plans for the next couple of years, and how do you currently structure your training?
Yeah, so I think coming off of that prep, I was pretty exhausted. And I think at that point I had known I had, exhausted my potential in terms of conditioning, or at least I was very content with it. And with natural bodybuilding, it's for me the enjoyment's in the process more than the competition itself. I a couple years have passed since then, and I'm not itching to compete, but I think I definitely see myself competing again at this point. At the time it was kind of, ride off into the sunset and be good with this, but I think, having sat on it a while, it's just too much fun to not do. Especially there is something about that, aged muscle maturity, whatever we want to call it. There's, I don't know if it's like thinning of, layers of the skin or what it is, but there is something about, the denser look, as we age, and it'd be nice to bring some conditioning in conjunction with, just a dense looking package. So I think it would be fun to do down the road, and with my kids being a little bit older by then, I think my son would think it would be a cool process to kind of follow along with too. So
sounds good, man.
But right now I'm just off season, just training. I might do a powerlifting meet this year. That's my goal for the year, is to get back on the platform. So right now, the overall program's definitely emphasizing volume and development as a whole. But I'm doing the big three and pushing some high intensities, once a week at least, and regaining some lost ground and lost proficiency in those lifts. So it's getting back to where I was, and if I can get back to beyond that and be in a position to PR at a meet, I'd love to do another one this year.
Cool. Hey man, that's great. So we can't count you out just yet, and I think it's pretty important to take a lot of time between shows, especially at your level of development. You will really need quite some time to make huge adjustments, improvements.
I think one thing with me is the last off season I was pretty heavily focused on powerlifting, and there were definitely some areas that did come up, but there were also some areas that I think were, they didn't get the attention that they deserved, and I think there's still room for improvement. I mean, we look at training age, and I think sometimes it's easy to assume, across the board everything's going to be at a snail's pace, but if you've neglected an area, I mean, that's one, medial delts, it's not like a huge glaring weakness, but it's something I've never really, I haven't put a year in where I've just consistently, hammered my medial delts or, really hit arms. And actually the past year or so has been, dialed back quite a bit in terms of powerlifting. I've gotten, 2018, 2019 were very minimal in terms of like heavy lifting, but I was still getting in there and probably actually trained my arms and delts more than I ever have. So it's you know, I'm hoping those will have some, you know, some pretty significant improvements the next time I compete. But other than that, it's, yeah, just refinement at this point, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. And one topic I want to touch on with you today is, of course, progressive overload. I mean, a really important training principle and just one of your areas of expertise. But I heard you talking about this topic on other podcasts already, and you were able to frame and communicate that so comprehensively. So I want to give our listeners a chance to listen to that as well. But first, I think we should define what an overload is before we touch on the progressive side of things. Overload, kind of sketchy term. So what is an overload, and when do we apply an overload when training?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions, you know, regarding the concept of overload. And I think a lot of it is, you know, it's built into the name itself. You know, overload insinuates, you know, load on the bar. And, you know, load can mean a lot of things. It can be, you know, total stress, total, you know, weight on the bar. But I think a lot of people look at it as, you know, doing more than previous. You know, you're surpassing a previous, you know, capacity, so to speak. When I think a better way to think of overload is, you know, just reaching and surpassing like an adaptive threshold within a training session. And I've been on a couple podcasts recently, you know, kind of touching on this. Usually when I'm on these, you know, the concept of overload comes up, and I wanted to mention, someone had written in or asked a question on the Stronger by Science podcast about Greg and Eric Trexler's opinion on, like, what are your positions on, you know, Brian Miner's thoughts on overload. And, you know, I since hearing that, I want to make it, you know, clear that, like, these aren't just my positions. Like, this isn't an original thought of mine. Like, Greg has thought quite a bit about this himself. And he actually added, you know, he kind of proposed the thought of, you know, sort of doing away with the term, you know, overload, and looking at it more as, you know, a subadaptive, an adaptive, and a maladaptive stimulus. So an overload stimulus would just be a stimulus that is going to spur an adaptive response. So that's the overload component. And, you know, each session, you know, there's going to be a range. You know, there's not a specific, you know, finite window of, you know, when overload is achieved. I mean, there's definitely like a minimum effective dose or volume, whatever you want to term it, that needs to be applied to, you know, tip the scale. Like, if we're talking about hypertrophy, it's, you know, tipping the scales in favor of, you know, synthetic pathways, you know, in the post-exercise recovery period. So, you know, that's also influenced by, you know, behaviors post-training as well. So, like, your overload threshold is, you know, it can be influenced by a lot of things. And, you know, training status is a big one. But, you know, if you can hit that threshold, but then not have, you know, a positive adaptation if you don't have the post-exercise, you know, support, or you don't create an environment conducive to that. So, you know, that, I guess that adaptive threshold is, you know, a conceptual line in the sand. But then you have to, you know, capitalize on, you know, crossing that in, you know, in your behaviors outside the gym. So
yeah, really good points. I think that was a great explanation. And what are acute indicators that tell us that we are inducing a stimulus which is sufficient enough to reach or surpass the threshold for adaptations? Is there anything we can look out? Is there any response after training? I mean, if we get a sore, or do we induce a good a pump, for example,
yeah,
anything that tells us, okay, we applied an overload during that session?
You know, I think there could be some things that, that correlate. You know, I think the most telling one would be performance. And that might not be, you know, acute enough to fit your question. But, you know, I don't think there's anything definitive, you know, within a session where it's like, ah, you know, I've hit that spot. You know, I think a lot of it is going to be based off of, you know, just your experience training with that level of volume and just kind of knowing, you know, if, I think a lot of it's sort of subjective in a way. It's like, you know, the sessions you go in and you're, you know, pushing the needle a little bit. And then, you know, the sessions that you go in, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to grow from that. You know, it's just, you're kind of going through the motions. So I think, you know, I don't think there's a definitive way to tell within a session. Like I think, you know, a pump is a good indication that you're, you know, training the muscle in question. I mean, soreness, I know, like Dr. Mike with Renaissance, I think he's a proponent of, you know, keeping an eye on some of those things. And I think, you know, there's something to be said for that. I mean, we are, you know, I think most would agree we're not trying to chase muscle damage. But, you know, if there's a muscle that's sore, you know, that tells us that we're placing tension on that muscle. So, yeah. I mean, it can speak to the, you know, efficacy of an exercise in terms of how it, you know, fits your, you know, mechanics and if it's a, you know, proper exercise for your, you know, for you individually. But, you know, I don't think there's any, you know, to my knowledge, any research that, you know, shows, you know, this, once you achieve a pump, you are across, you know, you're where you need to be, because, you know, you can do one set of push-ups and get a good pump. And you can do things that, you know, are just very novel and get very sore without, you know, placing a ton of mechanical tension on that area. You know, it's like you can, you know, do, like, I remember playing hockey growing up and doing some, like, off-ice, like, dry land training, and just some odd movements that I wasn't used to, you know. And, like, to this day, it was, you know, it was the sorest I've ever been in my life. But it wasn't, it wasn't anything, like, there was, you know, we weren't training against resistance at all, you know. It was just more plyometric and, you know, ballistic-type movements. But it was... Yeah, I think if you look at it and think, okay, can I, are there ways to achieve these effects without hypertrophy? In both cases, there are. So, but at the end of the day, I think they do provide something, and they're good clues. And assuming you're doing everything else right, I mean, I think they're, you know, decent, but they're, you know, there's not anything that's perfect. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, looking at performance, you know, across a block, or across, you know, blocks, and, you know, comparing things under equal circumstances, like, you're not just doing an additional rep because you pushed, you know, one rep closer to failure, but because you're actually stronger. You know, those are indications that some type of adaptation has occurred to accommodate that. Or, you know, it's also possible that, you know, you have to look, are the situations or the circumstances similar going into those sessions? You know, it's possible maybe the session you performed, you know, less on, you were, you know, more fatigued, mentally fatigued going in, or, you know, you slept like crap. And then, you know, a week later, you hit that session again, you're well rested and you get an additional rep. And, you know, that doesn't automatically mean in that case that an adaptation has occurred. It could just be, you know, the acute influencers are, you know, those acute variables are impacting things. And so, you know, I think we have to be careful when we look at any one thing as a, you know, telltale sign, but you have to look at everything, you know, the wider the lens we look through, I think the more telling that information is. And yeah, you just have to, there's just a lot to consider. It can get messy. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to get lost in all of it and overanalyze things. But you know, once you know you're making progress across a block and you're, you know, it's obvious that you're stronger, you know, across, you know, different rep ranges, across multiple sets, you just kind of have to trust that you're heading in the right direction, especially as a natural athlete, and let time do its thing, and you'll end up with more muscle for sure.
Of course. Yeah. I think as an advanced lifter, especially, you just look at your training sheet, you see the training variables, and you just know that will make me grow, basically. When you're a beginner, you're just doing fuck whatever. You will grow basically from anything. You have no idea what you're doing, but you will grow somehow. Yeah. But as an advanced lifter, you know, if you put in the work, you will definitely make adaptations. So
I mean, if it's not remotely challenging, chances are it's not going to do a whole lot. But it also does, you don't have to feel like you got run over either. So it's you know, there's quite a range there.
It should feel like a workout.
Exactly.
Yep. So yeah, let's move on to the progressive side of things, to the progressive overload principle. So what is the definition, and where do you think most people go wrong about it? What are ways to misinterpret it? And I will just let you all.
Yeah, so with progressive overload, I think it's what a lot of people look at it as is, you know, progressing the stimulus, like proactively doing more on a week-to-week basis or a session-to-session basis. Almost as if, like, each, you know, we talked about that adaptive threshold, as if that adaptive threshold is predicated on, you know, solely upon what you did the previous session. So it's like you adapted up to here, now you have to perform, you know, above it in order to spur adaptation. And that's not the case, but you know, the progressive aspect is more so, it's the observation of, you know, the ability to perform better as a result of prior adaptations. So, you know, you're able, you know, again, all else equal, you see now, like last week with, 50 kilos, I did 10 reps at an 8 RPE, and this week I did, you know, 11 reps at an 8 RPE. And so, you know, one thing I like to do is oftentimes program with, you know, sets that are maintaining a specific RPE. That way, you know, the athlete knows what load they're going to be using, most of the time, but they're chasing the RPE rather than the number of reps, right? Rather than an arbitrary number of reps. And so it allows them to go in, you know, chase the stimulus that we're after. Because, I mean, ultimately an RPE, you know, it's striking, or reps in reserve, you know, it's striking that balance between the stimulus that we're after and the cost associated with obtaining it, you know? So if we wanted to maximize the stimulus, if it was all about the stimulus, we would just train to failure all the time, but we have to balance that. So, by maintaining RPE set to set, it's helpful, in some cases, because you can look and say like, okay, now like I've worked up to this RPE. I'm now comparing, you know, apples to apples, and I can look back and say, oh wow, I did, you know, two more reps this week. And it's not to say that like having a number in the back of your mind is a bad thing. I think in many cases, you know, there is something to be said for, you know, the mentality of beating a logbook, because I think in many cases we're capable of more than we think. And you know, it's a source of accountability, but it's not necessarily a, you know, there's cases where people take it to the extreme and, you know, they have technical breakdown, which I know you wanted to discuss later, but, you know, you can bury yourself in an attempt to beat the logbook. But you know, there's also people that, you know, they think they're training at an 8 RPE, or, you know, two reps in reserve, whatever. And, you know, you look at the bar speed and you know, like with a little bit more experience pushing it, they're going to realize they probably have like 5 reps in the tank, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I do think, especially early on in an athlete's career, it can be helpful to use that, have a little bit of that mentality to, you know, beat the logbook, because it helps you more than anything. I think it just helps refine your ability to know what your capabilities actually are to begin with. And that's extremely important. Otherwise, you know, you could be, you know, operating in, you know, second gear the entire, you know, your entire career when you have, you know, another level you can go. So, you know, I think that's helpful, but I think where there's the misconception is a lot of people believe that, you know, adaptation, you know, the green light for adaptation hinges on beating the logbook, as if your, you know, body has a, you know, your body doesn't know how many reps you got, you know, it just senses stress and, you know, tension on the muscle. So, it's getting to the point where, again, you're tipping the scales in favor of synthetic pathways. And, you know, there's a point at which that starts to occur, you know, assuming post-exercise behaviors are on point. And then there's, you know, a whole window, you know, beyond that where that can still occur. Like you can go well past that and still have, you know, you may even have more optimal adaptations. And that, you know, goes into the idea of, you know, a minimum effective dose versus, you know, an optimal dose. But yeah, I think the progressive aspect is more, you know, the observation of doing more as a result of adaptations rather than the proactive pursuit of additional reps every session or reps or load.
Yeah, really good points. And I think it's usually a pretty good idea to just have the intent in mind to beat the logbook, especially for not rather beginners or intermediates, because yeah, they just have the opportunity to progress a lot faster than advanced athletes. And what my observation is, especially when I'm working with new clients, that they are able to progress a lot in their lift, especially in the first mesocycles, because yeah, a lot of times they train a little under their capacities, so that mentality brings them a lot faster to the point where they're training at or training with what they're actually capable of. But yeah, when you're kind of more advanced, I mean, seeing a progress, I mean real progress, increase in rep maxes from week to week most of the times won't be possible, because doing a mesocycle you're always like accumulating fatigue, and therefore your performance will be hampered just because it's the result of fitness and minus fatigue. So I would more like compare a mesocycle or like week three in a mesocycle to the next mesocycle week three, instead of like chasing higher numbers from week to week.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Is, you know, it comes back to comparing, apples to apples, and knowing that, you know, if you compare, fatigued state to a fresh state, then you're certainly going to be, you can make some misguided decisions with your programming. That's the case.
So, what is your overall observation? Are people pushing too hard within a time frame which is basically too small? If yes, is it within a single training session, a training week, or even a mesocycle? Where do people, where do you see people going wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think I see people all over the spectrum. You know, I see people that aren't training hard enough, people that are, you know, they're going to, that, you know, I would predict are going to have a deload brought on by an injury, you know, that are pushing too hard, and just non-sustainable. And a lot of it's, you know, younger guys. And, you know, I was the same way when I was, you know, in my early 20s, you know, would train extremely hard. And, you know, I think now as I've gotten a little bit older, it's like, I wish it was like, you can hear that wisdom, you know, being told to you when you're younger. And like, I can imagine myself hearing this, you know, when I was in my 20s and just still feeling like, ah, whatever, I'll deal with it then, you know. But yeah, I wish there was a way to experience that without having to get hurt, you know. To like, it's hard to appreciate the slow and steady approach, which is going to be what it is ultimately anyway with a natural athlete. But it's hard to like think, you know, programming with sustainability and longevity at the forefront when you're younger. But, you know, the older I get, it's, you know, the more that's the foundation of all of my decisions. You know, it's like, is my muscle maybe recovering, but are my, you know, is my connective tissue in a place where I can increase volume, you know? And that's, you know, you have to program based off of whatever the bottleneck in your recovery is. But yeah, I got off track a little bit there, but yeah, as a whole, I think it, I don't see one direction over the other. I think there's plenty of people that, you know, one observation I've had with the people that are pushing maybe too hard is the, you know, we know that volume is correlated with hypertrophy in a dose response manner up to a point. And that point is likely going to vary depending on a number of factors, you know, including training experience. But it's, I think a lot of people have sort of heard that message of, you know, volume drives hypertrophy and you need to do more volume over time, which I see. I think a lot of people that say that aren't really, maybe I think the message they're delivering isn't what they intended in some cases. Because doing more volume over time, you know, when you look at it in terms of, you know, number of sets, I think a lot of people, you know, they're starting to realize that number of sets is a good proxy for volume. You know, we know that intensity is, you know, isn't that important for hypertrophy, assuming, you know, relative effort is in place. So like when matched for sets, you know, anything between like a 6 to 30 rep max, for example, may be, you know, roughly equivalent. So, you know, they're sort of pushing the idea of, you know, number of sets is a, you know, a good way to think of volume, but then they're also saying volume needs to increase over time. When, you know, number of sets may not need to increase that much over time. And in my experience, it's fairly minimal, to be honest. I mean, because you have to realize each set carries a greater degree of training stress, you know, as you get older, or as you gain experience. But when you look at it as volume, like is, you know, defined by tonnage or sets times reps times load, yeah, that may go up over time. But that could go up over time without number of sets going up over time. So I think sometimes people are defining volume one way, but then they're saying volume needs to progress over time. And to someone who's not quite as, I guess, in tune with the research, or, you know, just someone, you know, that's trying to learn this, they may interpret that as I need to do more sets over time. Like I did 15 sets per body part last block, I made progress, but now I need to go to 16 or 17, you know, and eventually, you know, of course you're not going to be able to be, you know, 40 years old training, you know, 40 sets a week. So it's, so it's, I think a lot of the obstacles we run into, is, you know, evidence-based practitioners is you know, making sure everyone's operating off the same definitions of these terms, or making sure that when you're referencing the terms, you know, you're doing it in conjunction with defining how that term should be conceptualized in that circumstance. Because the do more volume over time is a good example of that. And I mean, I know, like, in my experience as an athlete, training, I think I started at age 16, and, you know, I'm 35 now. And in that time, you know, I bet if anything, I'm doing less sets per week.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think a lot of people start off just going, you know, following like these hardcore split body part routines, you know, from, you know, it. The people that are going, that are way overzealous, are usually people like beginner to intermediate stages, you know, because they haven't gotten banged up yet. I think the people that have finally, you know, gone through some tough times in terms of aches and pains, they sort of have learned to dial it back, or just realize that they can't recover from it, and, you know, the performance aspect isn't going up. So, yeah, I don't think number of sets necessarily. If it does, I think it can be fairly marginal. So yeah, that's kind of the big one I see, is just the misapplication of managing volume.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I think adding volume to your program is not a necessity, more like a tool to use when progress is basically not occurring and you're recovering. So see it more like that. And I think over the course of the training career, volume not has to go up necessarily, because as you said, you already mentioned that, for example, for me, I'm doing less volume or less total amount of sets for my quads than 2 years ago, but I'm growing them much better because I finally learned to really use them during an exercise. I was back then, I was like squatting more like a power lifter. I was looking all. I've hang around with power lifters and watch their technique and kind of imitate that. And I thought that was like the way to grow bigger legs, and I build up a really huge squat for me during that time. But as I focused more on, just fatiguing the local musculature, so to speak, I just learned to really engage my quads and use them as the primary tool to produce force. And that by itself lets my volume basically go down, because the stimulus for each working set is much higher now. And that's an observation I've made throughout my training career, and I think you experience the same with.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you bring up a good point in the fact that, you know, not every, like, a set isn't a set all the time. You know, it can be influenced by, you know, the way the exercise is performed, the exercise itself. You know, I think in, you know, research, we're looking at, you know, sets per body part, and, you know, in some cases, you know, it's treating like triceps, like bench is a set for triceps, you know, and tricep extensions is a set for triceps, you know, when in reality they're probably not equivalent, but that's just like kind of the best way we can do it right now, at least in the research. But like, you have to look at it in terms of, exactly like you said, the way that you're executing the exercise. I had an athlete a couple of years ago. I won't name him, but he came to me, and he was a natural bodybuilder, and he wanted more chest development. And he said, you know, my chest, it just, like, I need exorbitant amounts of volume for my chest to grow. And I think he was around, I think at the time, like including like flies. I think he was at 40 sets per week of pressing. So, I mean, it was a lot. Yeah. And so, you know, anytime I see somebody come to me with that, and, you know, this is a coach, you know, I have like an enrollment packet that people fill out, and, you know, I gather information about, you know, what their training heading in, you know, as I'm sure most coaches do. But, you know, anytime I see like an outlier like that, you know, I like to look at their lifting. And so I asked him to send a video of his pressing, and from the sides, like I said, filmed from the side. And, so he sent the video, and I mean, for pressing, I mean, you want your joints stacked, you know, you want your elbows below your wrist, you know, and in the direction of the force vector, you know, that you're pressing. And so, his elbows were drifting really far. Actually, they were behind the bar. So he was, you know, going down like this, and he was almost like internally rotating a little bit, but he, you know, was touching, you know, the weights pretty low, and not using like a ton. He was using a lot more shoulder, basically, and non-coincidentally, like fortunately, his shoulders, I don't think, had any like issues with them, but his shoulders were pretty developed. Like his shoulders were taking over everything because his elbows were, you know, just so far like behind the bar or behind the weight. And once he got them over, it's like all of a sudden, you know, he was more in line with, you know, to produce force with his pecs. And, you know, we cut his, like, lo and behold, his volume tolerance for pressing was, you know, right where you would expect it to be. And, you know, that's one thing I've noticed as a coach is, you know, that there's a lot of people that have these, you know, that kind of think they're a snowflake when it comes to their volume tolerance or their, you know, what's required. And there are people that do have, you know, these extreme circumstances, but, you know, I'd say more often than not, it's something that can be improved in terms of technique or exercise selection. And all of a sudden that number goes down. And so, I mean, even you can be even, you know, executing an exercise properly, but if it's the wrong exercise for you, you know, like incline press, you know, depending on, you know, the angle of your, you know, the sternal fibers, I mean, you could be doing an angle that is, you know, too steep, and it just doesn't make sense for you. You lower the angle, all of a sudden you're, you know, placing a lot more tension on those sternal fibers, and you're able to decrease your volume. So, yeah, it's always kind of a nice situation to run into. People, it's like, oh wow, all of a sudden I'm spending less time in the gym and I'm getting twice as much progress. That's pretty awesome. So.
Yeah, but, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I've experienced similar cases. Where clients just did an insane amount of work previously, and yeah, what I usually do is I dial them back and take really a look at the execution of the lift. If they're targeting really the local musculature, I usually just tell them to lift with intent. So for every exercise, we have like a primary driver, a primary muscle group, which should move like the main amount of force. And when you get them like into that perception, they are usually in a much better place to really hit the targeted muscle, and they are not using like other parts like your client on the bench press. So
yeah it's pretty interesting how like all the little variables that contribute to volume tolerance.
Let's touch a little bit more on the relative intensity point. I mean, I already mentioned that when I program a working set, I want the client or myself to take it to the point where the local musculature is like, a certain amount of reps away from failure, and that aligns pretty well with technique breakdown on especially compound lifts, because that prevents you from going like all out on a set of squats. Mm-hmm. I mean, two reps in reserve is usually not like a two reps in reserve, but it goes more to the point where you can't keep up a certain level of execution. Mm-hmm. So what I think is a really fine line is, where do you make that cutoff? Is it directly when you see hips shooting up on a squat, or just how much technique breakdown do you tolerate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, the way I look at breakdown in, you know, compound movements is the, if you're experiencing breakdown, it's either due to like lack of intent or just that muscle is fatigued. So take like hips kicking back in a squat. There can be a few contributing factors there. I think one of the big ones is, you know, quads aren't strong enough to, extend the bar vertically. So, you know, extends your hips back. And, but in other cases, and I've noticed this with myself, I think we have a tendency, and it's natural, to just go to the path of least resistance a little bit. Okay. And so, you know, your quads may be able to produce the force, but as soon as you sense that it's, you know, facing, you know, a decrease in velocity, it's like it's almost as if your muscles or your brain is like, let's just shift it to our hips and we'll go around it, you know? Whereas like your quads are probably able of finishing the job. It's just they're not, you don't really have that intent to hold that position. And then, you know, if there's also situations where you do have that intent where it's like all of a sudden you can't meet the force demand in that position for that muscle. And so you deviate or hips kick back. You shift some of the workload to, to your glutes and, some degree your hamstrings, like towards the top, but it's, I think it's easy. When I look at compound movements, I sort of look at it as, each muscle oftentimes it's like is operating on its own RPE scale in a sense. Yeah. And if you see breakdown, you can, like front squats are a great example, where, someone who doesn't practice, that front rack position regularly, like if it's not an Olympic lifter, does CrossFit, if I program front squats for a bodybuilder, or even a power lifter, I would say 8 times out of 10, it's their upper back that's like the limiting factor before their quads come into play. And so I think that's something when it comes to exercise selection, you have to pay attention to, because on paper, you look at it and you're like, wow, this is a really good quad builder. There's upright torso, the quite a long lever at the knee. It's like, this is going to be a good movement for your quads. But I know for me, it's like that upper back, that thoracic spine musculature is the bottleneck for sure. It's like that hits an RPE 10 when my quads are like a 4, So it's, so I oftentimes, like when it comes to, like isolation movements and I start to see breakdown, that's where I think it's usually an indication that somebody is, you know, they're deviating because the muscle is fatigued and it's no longer able to produce force in that position. So, you know, it's like when we start heaving with a bicep curl, it's because you can't maintain strict form. And it's like, if you're maintaining strict form and you're going, essentially breakdown at that point, it's sort of the same as like forced reps, you know, it's like you're just figuring out a way to get a little bit more tension on the muscle once you're already, you know, you've surpassed, the point that, you know, full motor recruitment's occurred. And usually that occurs earlier than most people think anyway, but, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
Totally. I think you mentioned some, really, really good points. And I think, yeah, you always have to fight technique breakdown in a sense, because the body will always get into a position where it's basically strongest. So, you have to kind of push against that. So for a squat, like trying to keep your spine neutral, your chest like maybe up, stay upright, and don't let your lower back round. So yeah, I think that's really important. And I think it was really interesting as well that you mentioned that on isolation lifts you should be maybe even more concerned about technical failure, because that tells us a lot, and that it's kind of counterintuitive to what I heard previously, because usually like the injury risk is much lower and you can kind of get away with like swinging a little on curls, getting your elbows a little bit forward. But what I did in the past is to like isolate my isolation lifts even more. So instead of like doing a standing dumbbell curl, I go to a preacher curl where I'll just have my arm in a fixed position and just like do the curl. And I really like it, and it's also a lot less psychologically fatiguing, and also overall less fatiguing. I mean, we're talking now about an isolation lift. I mean, the fatigue won't be too high, but if I go to curls after doing a lot of presses and rows, I mean, I'm not like really in a mental position to like stand there, hold the the dumbbell for the entire time. It's like also really hard. So if I go to like a preacher curl, I can just lay down and like do the movement and feel the muscle really well. So that's what I've been doing as well, even though the idea is basically that you can focus a little less on technique on isolation lifts.
And I think, you know, what I said, that can be interpreted a couple different ways, because I guess I'm not saying that, you know, every set needs to be perfect on an isolation movement. I'm just saying if the goal is to, let's say like the objective we're trying to achieve is, you know, 2 reps in reserve for a bicep curl, I think that point, I mean, you have to define where that bicep curl ends, you know. It's like, if it's as soon as fatigue starts to take place and you start swinging, I mean, you may be able to get 6 more reps doing that, but you've probably, you know, you hit an 8 RPE in terms of that original position, you hit that sooner. But I'm not saying, I mean, it's possible that, you know, those additional reps you're doing, like, yes, it's beyond where you had intended, but it is in a way, it's sort of additional volume in a sense, you know, like I'm not saying it's always bad. I'm just saying like the question of, you know, where, does form break down? Like, what does it signify? I think with an isolation movement, I think my main point was just that when you see breakdown there, it's usually a result of fatigue more than it is intent. Whereas on a compound lift, there is typically more, inherent risk with breakdown there, or, significant breakdown. And it can be attributed to both fatigue and, just lack of intent to hold a position or motivation to hold a position. Cause I know, like I used to see, looking at like my coaching, how it's evolved over the past few years with powerlifting. I used to see pause squats and pin squats, and I would never program them that often. Just because I found that the return on investment seemed to be better for most people just doing the competition lift. But I think in some cases, why a lot of people include like pauses or pin squats, they think, okay, to strengthen the bottom position, or, and there's something to be said for taking like that passive element out. You take like the elastic component largely out of the, or at least, to a significant degree out of the equation. But for me, it is more about, like now, like putting them in a position where it's like that intent to stay upright is there. It's like it's going to be uncomfortable it's going to be more uncomfortable to let your hips kick back than it is to just power through with your quads, And so there's a lot of, the longer I'm coaching, the more, the less I look at different movements that are out there and write them off as, a waste of time. There's always going to be some, but I think it's easy for, young coaches to kind of look at things that are, kind of far off on the specificity spectrum and think like, this looks like a waste of time. But you also have to think, if the coach knows what they're doing, they're programming that for a particular reason. And I know it's not always, not all coaches are going to be programming it probably for the right reason, but there are a lot that do. The psychological component is big. I'm a big believer, especially with powerlifting, in, just building confidence under the bar, and in different positions. And I think that, how can we achieve that while still achieving, the physiological adaptations that we're after, both in terms of development and, neurological adaptations. So, but there's some, like I was talking to Bryce Lewis a while back. Are you familiar with Bryce?
Yes.
Okay. So he, I think Eric Helms coaches him. He's coached him for a long time. And I think they had programmed some squats with chains a while back. And something that I hadn't seen him do before. And we were talking about it, and he had mentioned, it forces me, because it lacks a little bit of stability at the top, walking it out. Like, I have to be very deliberate in how I'm walking out the weight, and make sure I'm on point with everything. And I think that that takes it from an exercise where someone might think, is he trying to strengthen like the top portion of his squat, which doesn't really make sense in many cases, because it's like the most mechanically advantageous position of the squat. But like, you have to look at it as, what are they trying to accomplish here? And with Bryce, it's like, it helped him on a psychological level. And I think that's an area that's, getting more attention now. I think it can be taken to the extreme where people are, only trying to train, confidence in different positions. But, all of that contributes. And it can contribute to bodybuilding too. Being comfortable with an exercise. And I know, like with dieting, for example, the leaner I get, like, the weaker I get on things like squats, but when you're lean, you feel a little bit more fragile, and as I'm sure you've experienced, but that almost makes me focus more on technique, and it just makes me, like, ensure that I'm not sloppy with anything, you know?
Yeah.
So it's almost like a good refresher on, you know, technical efficiency, even though you're not able to move as much weight, because you know you'll, you know, you could break, or you have that fear in your mind, like, I could break if I don't, if I'm not on point here, or it feels like you could. So, yeah, so went a little off there, but.
Yeah, but I can totally relate to what you just said, especially like for the squat example. I mean, doing my, so to speak, powerlifting squat days where I intended to build muscle. I squatted three times a week. I was in a heavy surplus. I was carrying a lot of body fat, and I didn't focus too much on technique and more like... to move like the maximum amount of weight. And I was doing that three times per week, and that was like inducing a lot of psychological stress. And I was really like getting burned out doing that. I was sitting in the car before workouts and needed like half an hour to get myself up and move into the gym. Yeah. So since then I've been deviating a little from the back squat. I moved from three times a week slowly to two times per week, then to one time per week, and currently I'm just doing leg presses, Smith machine squats, and leg extensions, and that's going really well for me, and I'm feeling much more refreshed, and I can go into the session with the intent like to really fatigue the quadriceps fibers and not burst out as much reps with as much weight as possible. So that's a really, really cool thing here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just one last question. We already touched on the psychological fatigue. So I think for an hypertrophy athlete, the goal should be to accumulate more physiological fatigue than psychological fatigue, of course. So my question would be, how do you juggle physiological and psychological fatigue, and which characteristic is more often the limiting factor than the other?
I think for bodybuilders, I think probably physiological fatigue. You know, powerlifters, when I notice a lot of like psychological fatigue, it's more related to, and if you even want to call it fatigue, I think anytime we talk about fatigue, we have to, you know, define specifically what we're talking about. And I think all of us sort of look at it as, you know, subjective fatigue. But you know, physiological fatigue, I mean, these are things that can be measured. You know, this is things like, you know, central drive to, you know, the muscle, muscle damage, and, you know, peripheral fatigue, and, you know, within a set or across a session, you know, localized fatigue in the muscle. Whereas like psychological fatigue is, I think, more related to, you know, just being tired and unmotivated, you know? So all of these, you know, we sort of just throw the term around fatigue as kind of like the bottom line summation of all of these, you know?
Yeah.
But when you start to unpack it, you can kind of see how different aspects, you know, contribute in different ways, and, you know, what specific, you know, methods or strategies are, you know, what area are they trying to mitigate fatigue with? I mean, there's also like the structural fatigue that's sort of, I would lump into like psychological, just that like, and maybe some like central components, but you know, like a squat, like a heavy back squat versus a heavy leg press, you know, something that has a high degree of like axial loading is going to be, you know, more psychologically draining. And I think in a contest prep, I think the psychological side for bodybuilders starts to become more of an issue than it is in the off season. You know, I know there comes that point in prep where performance isn't, it isn't the best proxy for effectiveness of a strategy. And that sounds, you know, contradictory to what we said earlier, but you know, there's, you have to keep in mind, we're talking about all things equal, and in contest prep, all things aren't equal. You know, technique can radically change just due to, you know, changes in, you know, body fat, you know, range of motion at specific joints. And, you know, isolation movements, like James Krieger has a really good write-up on his member site on Weightology, that talks about progression for hypertrophy and like some of basically when it's appropriate and when it can be kind of misleading. But one thing that he, that stuck with me reading that was, you know, looking at isolation lifts across like a diet. And if you're trying to, you know, use performance as a proxy, those isolation lifts that are less impacted by changes in, you know, mechanics or technique, those are going to, like, you may notice like your leg press or your squats, like the, you know, my, my squat in a prep just, you know, it tanks. Like my bench press in a prep, like is a power lifter, you know, heading into prep in 2017, my bench was around like right around 400, and is, you know, as prep went on, I did a meet, and granted my shoulder was kind of bothering me a little bit, but, you know, even then, I mean, I think I did a meet as an 83 kilo, like 2/3 of the way through prep, just kind of for fun. And I think I hit like 335 or 340. So like it, it tanked my bench, but out of all my muscle groups, like chest probably retained size arguably the best. And so, you know, if you look at one exercise, it can be, you know, pretty psychologically draining if you think like, this is, I'm not going anywhere with this movement.
Yeah.
You know, I'm losing muscle when you start to kind of panic. But if I looked at like a, you know how like, those pec deck machines, like at the top, there's that pin and you can kind of adjust the range of motion. So yeah. I would make sure that that was the same each time. And I wasn't just like gaining range as I lost, you know, gain mobility. So I kept that the same. And I noticed like across prep, like that, I mean, that's a good proxy for just pec strength. I mean, it's just horizontal adduction, you know? So I noticed that, you know, that held up pretty much entirely, you know, like it didn't go down really much at all. So I think exercise selection, like I had this question on a podcast last week, and I wish I had thought about it a little bit more at the, you know, beforehand, because it was talking about how to like juggle training and contest prep and like manipulating variables. You know, does volume go down? You know, what do you do with intensity? And I think in my experience, the biggest variable that actually changes is probably exercise selection. Like that's one, like you have to find ways to, you know, continue to, you know, manage that psychological fatigue. Because, you know, motivation to train deep into a prep is, you know, that can be pretty low. You know, that's a concept, you know, Mike Isertel has talked quite a bit about, like the stimulus to fatigue ratio is what he's coined it. And it's just like the cost associated with achieving the stimulus for that exercise, you know, and is it worth it in your current, you know, the current landscape of recovery. And, you know, in prep, you have to be pretty selective, I think, of what you're doing. And, you know, we talk about the overload thing, you know, going back to that for a sec. It's like once you sort of understand overload as, you know, achieving an adaptive stimulus, you know, assuming you can, you know, you're proficient enough in a lift to maximize motor unit recruitment, which most advanced athletes, I mean, or intermediate athletes, like, you could hop on any bicep curl machine or method any day of the week and probably maximize motor unit recruitment. So I think that, you know, that learning component, it's probably a bigger issue, like, early on in untrained populations or in, you know, novice populations. So I think exercise variety at the end of prep, like the message of, you know, keep an exercise in place so you can maintain proficiency, so you can maintain, you know, maximal motor unit recruitment. I don't have any, like, direct papers to reference on this, but I would be surprised if, you know, advanced athletes or, you know, experienced bodybuilders, there was a huge detriment to changing exercises, you know, especially like machine work, you know, more regularly than maybe we would otherwise. But I think the benefit of keeping exercises in place is that ability to sort of compare apples to apples. But coming kind of full circle in prep, when you can't really compare apples to apples due to changes in leverages, you have to just find exercises that are still hitting the, you know, placing tension on the tissue that you want. And, you know, you're not dreading more often than not, you know, and knowing that, okay, if I, you know, assuming I'm executing this well, you know, my chest might need, you know, 15 sets per week. Like, that's kind of the sweet spot for me. And, you know, you can kind of pick from different areas in order to meet that quota and know you're still achieving an overload stimulus, even though it's different exercises. You know what I mean? So, sure. And I think that's another way to kind of drive home that point about overload is, you know, can you achieve an overload stimulus by just changing the exercise? And if the answer is yes, then we know it's not predicated on just beating what you just did on, you know, a specific exercise. So, so I think, yeah, the site, it's kind of more, I guess, concisely answer your question. I think the physiological fatigue and managing things like muscle damage and, you know, central, you know, CNS fatigue. I mean, the CNS fatigue thing, I think, it isn't as big of an issue as a lot of people think in resistance training. I mean, it can be, but muscle damage appears to be kind of the biggest thing that we want to control, I guess, or mitigate, and, you know, not rack up excessive amounts of muscle damage, because then that can in turn limit central drive. But, you know, the programming decisions manage the physiological fatigue, and I think when it comes to exercise selection in a prep, when psychological, that is when I see psychological fatigue being the biggest issue for people, is in a contest prep. Or just, they're just stale in the off season. They're just tired of doing an exercise. And that's where, like, variety, I think, kind of addresses that component.
Brilliant. I think you framed that really well. And yeah, you brought up a lot of great points, which we already mentioned earlier. So that, like, dwarfs the circle, I think, really well. Thank you so much, Brian, for that great content. I really enjoyed the discussion today. And yeah, at the end of each episode, we put a track on our Spotify playlist. We have, like, a Hypertrophy Cast playlist on Spotify. So I need a track from you, which you like to listen to, maybe on a hard working set. Do you listen to music?
Yeah, but I'm not. I don't know artists very well. I love music, but I don't. Like, I'll hear a song that I like, and then I just won't ever look and see who it is. But I'm not, like, a diehard. Like, I don't even have a Spotify. I'll put it that way.
Oh, good.
But I like shit. Let's see here. Amazon Music. Let's see what I was listening to recently. Let's see. I like M&M actually. But it's not my main.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Just
I like Spacebound by M&M. That's a good song.
Okay, cool.
And then you Snake Eyes by Mumford & Sons. That's another one that's on here.
Cool. Yeah, we'll take both.
Yeah.
Snake Eyes?
Yeah, Snake Eyes. That's probably better for me, actually. That's a okay. good song.
Yeah, we're going to go with that. Cool. Okay. I'm going to choose Hope from Lil Kane and Freddie Dredd. And do you know that?
No.
No?
Hope?
No, give it a try. Hope, yeah.
From... Lil Kane,
Freddie Duet. It's cool.
Okay.
I mean, if you're like into hip hop, I think you will like it. Maybe.
All right. Go for it. I'm good.
Yeah. Why not? Awesome, man. Cool. So, thank you again so much for your time. And
yeah. Yeah. My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, man.
Cool. If you like the podcast, as always, leave a like. Follow that shit on Spotify and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts if possible. Would help out a lot. And yeah, thanks for listening and see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.